Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 2:10 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is September 1st, and the Baltic Dry Index was down a little yesterday. We don't generally get the daily price until the next day on the index, but I think the more important point here is that the price right now is back around where it was in 2009 and 10, and it was higher than that back even in 2004 and 5, and that is quite apart from the big spike in higher that we had that accompanied the big pop on the oil price back in 2007 and 2008. Now, that was when inflationary pressures were really starting to ramp higher. And it was around the same time that interest rates were also rising. So these were important factors. But I think there's also the additional point here that when we look, I thought I saw this this rather interesting graph in here today. And I think it's interesting because one thing that they're trying to highlight here is that when central banks start to raise interest rates, that you generally get a benign market outcome. But the problem is that the effect of interest rate hikes is cumulative. So the market becomes progressively more sensitive to each additional interest rate hike. And generally, central banks are reluctant to raise interest rates until they are comfortable with the capacity of the market to accept those kinds of moves. So when we look at what's happened in the past, well, generally speaking, the market can do fine without the benefit of interest rate hikes. And generally then it's also when they start to raise interest rates in a concerted manner, that's generally when we start to run into trouble. So we are nowhere near raising interest rates yet, and it would be rather unusual to see a market peak of significance. Doesn't mean that we can't have the occasional pullback in the order of 10 or maybe even 20%, but a pullback of significance without an interest rate hike cycle occurring beforehand. We haven't had any evidence yet of a taper tantrum either. So we're still in a benign market environment despite the presence of inflationary pressures. And I think it's important to realize that some of these inflationary pressures are transitory in that they'll come and go, and others will be with us for the significant medium term, and others might never reverse. So we're definitely seeing the price of shipping items around the world increasing. But I think it's also, it's not simply about the fact that shipping costs are rising. It's the cost of regulations and abiding by regulatory oversight is also increasing. So we can go back and think about what was happening in 2019, because the shipping index was, or the shipping companies had been doing reasonably well heading into the end of 2019, and then everyone came to the realization that there were going to be much stricter emissions controls imposed, and a significant number of companies went bust. And investors left the industry in droves, and they didn't come back again until the demand side of the equation started to pop up in the aftermath of the pandemic, and then it was greeted with an absence of ships. So we're in a supply inelasticity meets rising demand environment, and the profitability of the existing stock of shipping companies has improved immeasurably over the course of the last year. So they are doing really quite well as a result of this increased regulatory oversight, which basically increases the cost of participation. So there's going to have to be a new building cycle for the the global shipping sector. And until we start to see a lot more new ships that comply with the IMO 2020 regulations and the potential for even stricter regulations in future, well, then we're likely to continue to see additional upward pressure on shipping costs. And that's a medium-term consideration. Then we can also think about the fact that there are significant headwinds for the oil sector. And companies, they're reluctant to invest in exploration, and they're reluctant to invest in additional drilling programs. So there is a running argument right now about whether the North American or US oil production has in fact peaked. I think more accurately, US domestic unconventional oil and gas production has already peaked, or whether this is a function of the absence of drilling, because companies were heavily impaired by the negative prices on WTI last year. They've been extremely reluctant to invest in new drill programs, and then the investor class has been chastened from investing because of the extraordinary volatility that we saw last year, and because they become under significant pressure from the green or environmental lobby, and then the entire energy sector is having greater difficulty raising cash from investors because lots of endowments are no longer allowed to invest in fossil fuels. Well, again, that has nothing to do with the economy, but much more to do with the cost of complying with increasing regulation. So when you have the Biden administration talking about looking at anti-competitive cartels within various parts of the commodity supply chain, whether it's in the energy sector or the food sector, well, it's one thing for companies to conspire to keep prices high and to ensure their profitability, and anti-competitive measures should be combated by governments. There's no real debate about that. But there's absolutely no discussion about the increasing regulatory burden that the entire economy is facing, because shipping costs were higher than they are today on numerous occasions in the past, and yet there wasn't nearly the same sense of rising inflationary pressures. And now we can think about the continued upward pressure that we're seeing on carbon credits. Now, it's a little overbought in the short term, and it has been weaker of late, and it does, in many respects, take its cue from the outlook for oil prices. But the Europeans want to have a 100 euro price for carbon, and it's currently at 60. So I think we can expect some additional volatility, but eventually it will trade back up towards that, or it's not back up towards, it'll trade towards that target level that politicians have set for it. And then we can think about agriculture prices. So the Invesco Agriculture Fund tracks futures prices, and it's been pausing over the course of the last 4 months, but it has clearly broken the downtrend, and that was an awfully long downtrend. So, because it's a futures traded fund, then it deals with the contango, and the contango is reflected in the downtrend. It's only when prices actually start to turn higher and we have backwardations that these kinds of futures funds actually perform. So, it's a special time in commodity markets when these kinds of future funds that don't actively manage their contango actually start to turn around. And it's generally emblematic of commodity prices rising. So there are certainly a lot of worries about whether we're going to see commodities coming under sustained supply pressure, and there's worries about the global supply chain and the impact that the pandemic is having overall. But again, there is a lot less discussion going on about what exactly needs to be done in order to make sure that there is ample supply, and the kinds of roadblocks that have been imposed on farmers don't seem to get very much discussion at all. When we then think about the upward inflation that we're seeing in foodstuffs generally, well, it's not coming through so much in the grains and beans. It's coming through in other portions of the market because soybeans have pulled back in here today and they are now sustaining this move below the trend mean. So we're starting to see some of the downward pressure that we saw, for example, earlier in the lumber price now starting to come through in the grains and beans. Although lumber, having gone up in an incredibly abrupt manner, came down even faster and is beginning to show initial signs of support coming through in the region of the lows from late 2020. So it's more likely than not that this higher price environment overall will be sustained. And I think it looks quite unlikely that we're going to see prices coming back down below the 400 level. So we're in a new price environment overall, and this breakout is likely to be sustained, and that we're looking at the significant potential for the price to continue to trade up above levels that prevailed from about 1992 until 2020. So again, this has been a step change in commodity prices, and I suspect that that's what we're going to see in other commodities too, that it's a volatile asset class, so we can anticipate that there will be additional volatility in these sectors. Now, we can also then think about the reality that governments aren't willing to roll back the kinds of regulatory burden they've imposed upon producers. So the Biden administration is beginning to talk about price controls. Now, they're not calling them price controls, but what they are talking about is attempting to bring prices down in a forceful manner. So they're not relying on the market as a market clearing mechanism, and that and the general rule from commodity markets historically has been the cure for high prices is high prices because it encourages new supply into the market. But when the government steps in and stops prices from rising, then they interfere with the market clearing mechanism. It destroys the ability of the market to increase supply, and therefore, demand increases into an environment where supply is inhibited because of price controls. Then that keeps a lid on headline inflation pressures, but then the pressure inside the market continues to build when the failure of the price controls eventually overwhelms the situation, then prices break out in an extraordinarily abrupt manner. And that is exactly what we saw in the 1970s. And gold took off like a rocket in that kind of environment. I think it's also worth considering that in the 1970s, inflation was not persistently high, that it came in bursts. And in between those bursts, the rate of increase fell off, but never went negative. So we're likely to have a similar situation on this occasion. And eventually, investors will start to become enamored with anything that can hold its value. So gold is certainly one of those types of assets. And on this occasion, I think people are also looking at cryptocurrencies. So Bitcoin continues to steady within this range as it holds below this psychological 50,000 level. Ethereum has, excuse me, better type in the right ticker. Ethereum has broken on the upside and was up over $300 in here today, so clearly breaking out of this range and looks likely to push on to test the highs from May of this year. A number of the altcoins are doing much better. So this is also emblematic of increasing appetite for risk. So we're definitely seeing a lot of enthusiasm coming through in markets. And we can think about the continued strong performance that we're seeing on Wall Street. Now, Wall Street has been eking out new highs, and it's been failing to sustain upward breaks for most of the last 6 months, but it hasn't been pulling back by very much either. So every time it breaks out to a new high, it makes it susceptible to another one of these little pullbacks, and each of the pullbacks has been limited to about 5%. It's going to have to pull back by more than that and break the sequence of higher reaction lows in order to really suggest that we have anything other than a short-term peak. And the strategy that has worked best this year has been buying the dips. So buying the dips will have to fail in order to clearly demonstrate that we have a peak of anything other than very short-term duration. Then we can think about the rest of the world. So we continue to see that markets that would be considered value are continuing to play catch up, but we have a large number of short-term overbought conditions. So it wouldn't be beyond the bounds of possibility that we see some of these developed markets beginning to roll over, and some of those that have been neglected, like Japan, starting to move back into a position of outperformance. And the move back into Chinese markets continues. So China's market was up again in here today, and it's the eight, excuse me, the CSI 300 is firming from the lower side of its range. The Hang Seng, having been up in a pretty dynamic manner yesterday, was in additional positive territory in here today, so continuing to firm from that psychological 25,000 level. Then we can think about the Indian market, which is really quite overextended, and it was in negative territory today, but certainly in no way was it a dynamic move overall. So we may just see some pause and consolidation overall, and that would be a benign influence. One of the big sources of inflation is semiconductors. Taiwan Semiconductor is raising prices by 20%. So the dominant position the company has in the market is helping to support the price, and it continues to firm from the region of the trend mean. But one thing that we're certainly seeing right across the Asian region is that banks are turning to outperformance, and the Taiwanese banking sector has pushed on and hit a new high in here today. Then the Korean financials have also been turning back towards outperformance. So we're definitely seeing that the financial sector in Asia is starting to do better, and that is despite the fact that China's banks have been rather weak, and that there are pressures within the high yield sector within China. But as the world comes to terms with the coronavirus, and as Asia begins to open back up, then there is certainly the potential that growth will be, I think, outperforming across most of Asia. And we are still in an extraordinarily benign monetary environment, and we're nowhere near the first interest rate hikes yet. But we certainly have a lot of enthusiasm for risk assets. And this is being manifested certainly in the cryptocurrency markets. And then there's a lot of enthusiasm in the IPO markets. I saw a headline yesterday to the effect that Fidelity is in the market for 5,000 new employees. They've had such an incredible influx of new customers that they are racing to try and deal with the customer management that they now have to do. And they're hoping that they'll be able to sell lots of those new customers higher priced products like financial advice. And of course, Fidelity has been extremely active in providing cryptocurrency custody services. So they're also heavily involved in trying to get people into and offering people exposure to that market. And this is extremely similar to the kind of activity that we saw in the 1990s, where asset management companies were racing to hire people to provide services to investors that, and back then, all they wanted to do was to buy every new IPO. And we're getting something similar to that in here this time around, except that its investors are eager to buy each new cryptocurrency and each new non-fungible token. And the wisdom of doing that and the faddishness of chasing these assets in the hope of making extraordinary sums, then that's eerily similar to what we had in the 1990s. But the most important thing to remember is that buying IPOs in the 1990s worked, and it worked for a good long time before interest rates rose and really became an obstacle. So the most important thing to, I think, pay attention to today is the monetary outlook. And as long as we're still in a benign monetary environment, then asset prices are likely to surprise on the upside. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.